Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM 103.7. I'm Patricia Cavallari, and in this series we shall be hearing from academics about their research and from students and other members of the campus community about the many activities which will be taking place during the coming year. I'm delighted to have with me today on University Matters on Campus FM, Ms. Liz Smith. Just a word about my guest. Liz Smith is a science communication specialist who brings with her more than 10 years of extensive experience in science-specific communications. She holds a Master of Fine Arts in Science and Natural History Filmmaking and an undergraduate degree in astronomy. Liz has spent the last 6 years working in ocean expedition communications and has worked as a science communications director aboard research vessels in the Pacific Ocean, the Caribbean, and the Mediterranean. Prior to working on ocean research, she produced films about astrophysics and earth science at NASA and also produced documentary work for the US National Park Service. She's a member of the Fulbright Specialists roster and the American Mensa. She's also certified as an advanced and rescue scuba diver, a single-engine private pilot, and a wilderness emergency medical technician. Her specialties then are at-sea media production and logistics, branding and PR for science, and conservation organizations, science communications training and development. Ms. Smith is here in Malta as a Fulbright scholar. She's hosted by the US Embassy and is working with Dr. Aaron McCullough, who is a senior lecturer at the Department of Physics within the Faculty of Science here at UOM. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Liz, if you don't mind, I'll call you Liz. I suppose that after a bio like that, one really has to ask oneself, where do I even begin to ask you a question? There's so many things in that career trajectory. Quite amazing. However, perhaps I can start by asking you a basic question, a definition. It's always a good place to start, of science communication, because it's become rather a sort of buzz expression these last years. And how necessary is it today, and also why?
Sure. Science communication, it has become a buzzword, thankfully, because it's very important. I have a very wide definition of science communications. Some people like to sort of narrow it down to just popular media, things like science documentary and science magazines. I reverse it and say it's communicating science. So it's anything that includes that, including educational materials, everything from how you teach a class to even the business end of science, which would be communicating to philanthropists or funders. Any situation in which you're trying to get your science across, engage people to either act on it, just be more knowledgeable about it, fund it, whatever it is. And the reason why it's so important, I think, is partly because of, actually I brought up funding, part of it is because of making sure that science continues to get funded, to make sure that people know why it's important. And with the general public, make sure they know that they support that funding. It's also important because of social issues like climate change, where the general public really needs to start supporting different sort of efforts in those realms. And I do a lot of ocean work as well, so things like fisheries and ocean acidification. Folks just, it used to be that there wasn't that much going on, and so scientists could go off and do their thing. But nowadays, we really need an informed and engaged public. So that's part of why I got into the work that I got into.
Yes, let's start off with the initial stages of your career, which involved science filmmaking, as that seems to be where your career began. And then perhaps we can go on to talk about now the use of multimedia, because that is the way things are really going, and perhaps using more than one media to actually put across the same idea and how one might use those multimedia to reach your science communication goals.
Sure. Actually, the course of my career is sort of indicative of where things are going, I think, in general, in that realm in terms of using multimedia. I actually started out as a science major and then found that I enjoyed telling stories about science much more than I enjoyed actually doing the science. And so I went and did a Master of Fine Arts in Science Filmmaking. It's actually a science and natural history filmmaking, so we also did a lot of wildlife and outdoor work as well. And film is great. What I've noticed over the years, I mean, I did a program that was sort of very high-end film, sort of like Discovery Channel or BBC, that kind of end of things. But nowadays it's so democratized that anyone can pick up a camera and go make something. When I started in film, to have access to cameras was a really big deal, especially high-end cameras. And
they were huge.
And they were giant. I mean, some of the first things I worked on were, when I was at NASA, we worked with beta tapes and, I mean, very large media. And nowadays, you know, you can make a movie on your phone, which is incredible. I think that's a wonderful thing. And so my career sort of tracked that in that I started out making sort of, classic documentary. And over time, because of the advent of social media and also just the fact that you can now make something with your phone, I've managed to end up doing more social media work. And I think that's really important, is the idea that nowadays it's not necessarily these sort of gatekeeper people that are in the middle that, you know, translate between the scientists and the public. You actually have scientists making their own media, which I think is much more authentic, and it connects people actually much better. Some of the issue with that, and part of the reason that I do a lot of training in science communications, is because it's not simple to make something, and when you do make something, there's ways people take it and how you come across. And so a lot of what I do is working with scientists to train them in that media so that they have an understanding of how they're coming across their audience and if their message is getting across and if they're actually sort of telling people what they want to be telling them.
I would have thought that it was extremely important to have somebody like yourself who had a science background and a science training, who is actually hands-on with the media itself, because although you're talking about democratization of media and mobile phones and this sort of thing, but to make the kind of high-end quality films in a natural habitat that we as an audience have come to expect is not something that you can necessarily do with a mobile phone so easily. I mean, it's pretty complex stuff, and you really need very good training to be able to do that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. Yeah, definitely. And I think there's still very much a place for that, that kind of media, the classic sort of TV documentary. And some of what I do also, aside from training scientists how to do media, a lot of it is also just sort of awareness raising among scientists how difficult it can be to make something that is high quality. And I think there's just two ends of the same sort of spectrum of trying to communicate science. It's that you can do something very sort of high-end and very well-made, but you can also do something that is more sort of an everyday person type thing. And I think both of those things are useful. Especially as we try to connect scientists with the general public. But yeah, if you're trying to make something that's very high quality, you absolutely need someone who knows what they're doing. It's very hard. A lot of people think they could just go do it, and it's actually difficult to come across the right way.
I think that what we also, as an audience, I count myself as an interested watcher of these kind of documentaries, we have come to expect actually both ends of the spectrum, the kind of the very top excellence as far as quality is concerned. And also people are very interested in the spontaneous. And the BBC, for example, often asks their viewers to send in things from their own gardens, mm-hmm. for example. That, yes, there's a place for that as well.
Yes, yeah, I think sometimes with science, especially in recent years, we've gotten sort of disconnected from it in a lot of ways, which is part of the reason why it's really important to communicate science. But I think part of it is communicating the human part of science. So connecting with science, when you can actually see a scientist's Facebook page and you actually see them, you know, with a selfie or, you know, the food they're eating or whatever, that kind of fun stuff, it makes you realize that they're real people and they're just like you. And so I think that helps a lot. I think the other thing that I've seen a lot too is with some of the higher end stuff like Discovery Channel and National Geographic, they've gotten away from doing a lot of the serious science. And I think it's unfortunate. I think sometimes too, part of the program that I did in the Master of Fine Arts, the reason that program was started was to train scientists in film so that you could have folks on both sides of it making those films rather than just, sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes it's the documentary folks who don't have enough science training and background to understand sort of what to make, and they kind of make a mess of it sometimes.
Yes, as we were saying, we were just chatting before coming on air, sometimes the discovery nowadays doesn't quite live up to its original, the expectations we had of it, perhaps.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, and some of that is trying to bring that back to it. Because of that kind of, there's a little bit of a distrust. There's sort of a gap between scientists and media and journalists. That can be difficult, and part of it is because they come from very different cultures. You know, science is very factual. They attribute every citation, everything is attributed. And so in media, we often need a short, quick grabbing title. You can't name every single author on a paper. It's just a very different world. And a lot of my job, actually when I was working at NASA, was working in between those folks, was sitting down with a scientist and sitting down with an animator or a creator or a TV producer and trying to help translate and get them to meet in the middle where you get the best of both worlds.
I was looking at the description of your 2-year tenure at the Ocean Exploration Trust, and you mentioned access to schools. How important do you see this kind of activity?
Oh, I think it's incredibly important. Another buzzword right now is STEM education, or STEAM education. It's science, technology, engineering, and math. And some people have added an A for arts into that as well. And that STEM education is basically trying to get students into those fields. Because we see, especially in the U.S. actually, we see a decreasing amount of folks going into things like engineering. And we need engineers. We need scientists. And so STEM education is very big, getting kids engaged in it, and making science something that is, you know, exciting and fun and something that you want to be when you grow up, versus sort of a lot of kids think of math as being, you know, unless you're really a math kid, you know, math is something that you just hate doing when you're a little kid. So trying to get kids to see just how exciting that can be and what kind of careers that can lead to. And when I worked with Ocean Exploration Trust, we actually had a live website. It's still up and running, called Nautilus Live. And Nautilus is the name of the ship. It's an exploration vessel. They do undersea research. They take remotely operated vehicles, ROVs. They're kind of like underwater submarines without people on them. And they go down to the depths and explore and look at everything from geology to biology to archaeology. And what we did is basically, they have a website, and it's a live feed from the ship. So during the summers, when they're out exploring, you can actually watch underwater live out in the middle of the ocean what they're looking at. And then you can also follow all of the dialogue amongst the folks that are operating the vehicles, from the engineers to the scientists. You can hear them chatting and what they're saying about things as they explore them and discover them. And then you're also able to write in and ask a question and say, hey, what is that? Or even, how can I get into this? How did you get into, you know, get into this field from being a kid? And we started doing that. We also would do live chats with classrooms specifically. So we'd have a class of, you know, 30 kids, and we'd go on air with them, and they get to ask questions of all of our explorers. And that group is led by Bob Ballard, who, Dr. Robert Ballard, he found the Titanic, and he also discovered hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean back in the 1980s. So he's
an
also
an inspirational figure.
He is, and he's great. He works with kids. I mean, that's one of his most favorite things to do. And he still gets, you know, dozens of letters every day from students who want to be just like him when they grow up. Or researchers who are grad students who now have their PhD who said, hey, I got into this because of you. So it's a really neat thing to see that. I think it's incredibly important for the next generation to inspire the next generation to study these things.
And also, I suppose you do work with training the trainers themselves, the teachers themselves, because mm-hmm. ultimately you might have a one-off or an occasional event of the ones you've just been mentioning, but it's the teacher on an everyday basis that's going to have to continue to inspire the students as they go along.
Yes, absolutely. And I know that it's tough for teachers too, because they're trying to juggle students now in class have their iPhones and their, you know, all their technology, and so they're trying to keep up with all of that. And I think that's something that's really important in terms of multimedia and science education, is developing tools for for teachers to use in their classrooms to engage students in the technology rather than just old school textbooks, you know, that just doesn't really do the trick anymore.
Perhaps we're in a difficult position at the moment because technology has moved so fast and teaching methods have perhaps been rather the same for a long period of time. And it must be difficult to make that change for the teachers as they go along now.
Oh, absolutely, because they have to keep up themselves with what's going on. I mean, we all know how hard it is to keep up with what's, you know, what's hip and what's going on right now. I even have a hard time myself, and it's in my field, trying to keep up with what apps are new and what, you know, what social media is new, what's going on, and especially what the kids are doing, because they're always a step ahead when it comes to that kind of stuff. Yeah, I can't imagine how difficult that would be to try to keep up and then also teach students.
Something that caught my eye when I was reading your CV was this, and I quote, establishment and implementation of crisis communication protocols for an emergency search and recovery operation off the Syrian coast, for which you received commendation from the U.S. Secretary of State, no less, Hillary Clinton. Tell us about that. Sounded fascinating.
Sure. That's sort of an aside to the science communications talk, but... Yeah, that was actually the group we were just talking about, Ocean Exploration Trust, and Bob Ballard. I was working for him, and this was 2012, a couple years ago now, in the summer, and we were out in Istanbul working, doing archaeology work, actually, mostly off the in the Black Sea, looking at ancient shipwrecks, sort of Roman shipwrecks. And at the time, there was sort of an international incident where the Syrians had shot down a Turkish jet. That had strayed into airspace. I don't even know what the exact details are now in terms of who was where and what exactly all happened. But they shot this jet down, and we happened to be the closest sort of research vessel that had the right equipment to go find it and recover it. So we ended up going, and we at the time we were not part of it. Also, you know, the situation was somewhat tense, obviously, in that area. And we went in with the Turkish Navy and the Air Force to go help them recover this. And we weren't a U.S. Vessel at the time. We were flagged, I think, in the Caymans. And our crew was Ukrainian. We had Australians and Brits and Turkish folks, real international mix of folks on board. So it made it better for us to go in there in that way. And we went and we did sort of sonar and found it, and then did some recovery and brought parts of the plane back up and helped them recover their folks, and then went on about our business. Mm-hmm. But it was a fairly tense situation, but it was also just absolutely amazing to take part in as well.
Yes, I can imagine. It must have been an incredible experience. Again, looking down your CV, I came across the time you spent at NASA Goddard's Space Flight Center. And you really did some very interesting things. That was back in 2004, 2008.
Yep.
And you created NASA's first YouTube page.
I did.
I think that's really, really sort of marked that up as an important moment in your career,
yeah.
I would have thought. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's fun. When I got there, it's incredible to think that YouTube and social media has only been around for about 10 years. But yeah, when I started there, I actually went there originally as a fellowship student out of grad school, and ended up staying on. After I finished my degree, I ended up getting hired on for a couple of years as an astrophysics producer. And one of the things that I did while I was there was start to bring the social media, into play with our communications department. Because thus far, it had mostly been traditional media, which made sense because that's where we sort of were in the world in general. But yeah, I started the first YouTube page, and back when Facebook didn't have organization pages, it was just people. We were launching a satellite, and we wanted to get kids involved and get people connected. So we actually started a Facebook profile for the satellite as if it was a person, and so you could become friends with the satellite. And back then, that was sort of cute and fun. Nowadays it's like, oh yeah, you know, there's tons of pages like that, but back then we were sort of really trying to innovate and figure out, you know, where things were going with that. So that was a lot of fun.
Yes, and you managed to create a lot of likes, I think, on that page. You also collaborated with astrophysicist Dr. John Mata on his 2006 Nobel Prize multimedia presentation for the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum. I mean, that really must be a marker
yes.
in your list of career markers.
Yes, I would put that. That's probably right at the top. Having studied, you know, astronomy and astrophysics also, and then getting to work at NASA at all was you know, a highlight of my career. It's absolutely amazing. And at the time that I was at NASA, you had Dr. John Mather, who's an astrophysicist, and he built the COBE satellite, which took the first, they call it the baby picture of the universe. It's the cosmic background radiation shot. And they built the first satellite. There's been numerous satellites since then that have taken better and better and better pictures of it. But they sort of took the first one. And
this was in the 80s?
Yes, it was in the 1980s, yes.
I do definitely remember the name.
Yes.
And how important it seemed to be at the time and was.
Yes, and I think they started building it in the 70s. I mean, those projects take decades. And John had, sort of steered this satellite, the making of this satellite and project. Yeah, they announced the Nobel Prizes in 2006, and John was one of them, and he is in our department, and that was my department. So I lucked out and got to work with him on a lot of his Nobel work and sharing that work. And the big one was a presentation that we did on the IMAX screen at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum, which is also one of my favorite museums in the world.
I can imagine. it would be.
You mentioned I do have my pilot's license because I grew up with that, and I love flying in airplanes as well. It's something that if I have a second career, it's going to be something to do with that. But so the Air and Space Museum, yeah, we put together a whole presentation for NASA folks and media and journalists about, not just about the Nobel, it was what John ended up talking about was sort of where we were going in the future also, because he's now building the JWST satellite, which is a new satellite program. So he sort of, and I loved this about John, he didn't necessarily want to talk about the past and what was done and what he won the Nobel, but he wanted to talk about the future, you know, what's next, what are we doing, what should we be excited about now, which is why he's who he is. He's absolutely incredible. I love him. So, yes, I got to work with him and do that. It was, yeah, an absolute highlight.
Yes, you did other things while you were there. I'm just sort of reading through now. Established and implemented communications plan for the launch of the Fermi satellite mission, including one of NASA's earliest video podcasts.
Yes, yeah, back in the day before podcasts were normal, too. It was NASA. Like I said, we were trying to be on top of things. The Fermi satellite, back then it was called GLAST. They have a thing in with NASA where they name the satellite while it's on the ground while they're building it, and then as soon as they launch it, they rename it. It's sort of a christening type thing. And sometimes, I think Fermi, they may have actually done a public poll. Sometimes they actually poll people and get ideas for satellite names and have, like, students vote on them, that kind of thing. But, yeah, that was another one as well, going from start to finish. We're building this satellite. We need to be able to promote it and get people to know what it's about and all of that. And I worked on that whole project with them up until just I left NASA right before launch of that satellite. So, and it's good to see because now it's been years and they're getting data back and they're finally publishing papers. And it's cool to see the long-term results of that because they put in, like I said, decades of their lives to get those done, which can be hard in science communications to get across, when we watch a documentary, it all happens in an hour. It all happens in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. These folks spend, you have hundreds of people who spend 20 years making sure these things get up there and
yes,
are able to
and
get
work.
That one picture.
And when they don't work, of course,
when yeah,
it's
exactly,
tragic.
Exactly. It's heartbreaking. Every time I see a launch that fails or something like that, I mean, it's just, people think, oh, it didn't make it or whatever, but it's like, oh, that's just.
Can you imagine, spending 20 years doing something and then it misses?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Terrible. Well, in the last few minutes that we have, perhaps we could talk about the Fulbright Scholarship.
Yes.
And your visit here to Malta, how that came about and what you've been doing since you've been here and this sort of thing.
Sure. I can tell you about the Fulbright. So for folks who don't know, Fulbright is a U.S.-based program that's sort of it's an academic and cultural exchange program in the States. They do have Fulbrights for foreign students to come to the U.S., so anyone who's listening in Malta should definitely check into it. As a U.S. citizen, I had heard about it because there's a couple of Fulbrights. One of them is for students to come for a year to study at a foreign university. There's another one that is for professors to go teach at a foreign university. And then there's the Fulbright Specialist Program, which I'm in, which is, it's a shorter term. It's a 2 to 6 week grant. And it's for academics, but it's also for professionals as well. And the idea is that you're paired with a university, usually a department, where they'd like some consultation on something or some help with curriculum development or training for their staff and their professors. And so I connected with Dr. Aaron McAuliffe here at UOM. And he's actually a marine geologist. And I met him through, I met him through my brother, actually. My brother is a marine biologist. And we work together often on projects, especially out in the Mediterranean and Croatia and Albania and Sicily and out here in Malta doing sort of underwater archaeology. And I met Aaron, and he said, yeah, you should come out to the University of Malta, and we could really use some help, you know, learning about science communications. And so we worked with Fulbright to create this grant. And I came out in September for 4 weeks, and then I'm here this time for 2 weeks to complete the grant. And I've given a number of lectures, and a lot of it has mostly been meeting with department staff to talk about how to better communicate their work, because they're doing some great work here.
Well, in fact, it's very appropriate that you should be here this year, because this is the 100th anniversary
Yes.
of the creation of the Faculty of Science. So I think it's a nice opportunity for the faculty to have somebody like yourself who's going to be putting their side of the story out there, really.
Yeah, definitely. And I have to say, too, I'm incredibly impressed with UOM and also just the local interest in science here. I went to this Science in the City event in September and that Edward Duca put on, and it's just absolutely incredible. I could not believe just the public engagement. The amount of
thousands of people go to Valletta.
And not only that, how many people were there, but they were really engaged. You know, you could see, I mean, they were stacked, you know, five back in crowds, trying to interact with the science students that had come out to help share things, and some of the big presentations, and then also just the combination of art and science as well, I thought was just absolutely incredible. So I'm actually working with Aaron here to try to possibly plan something, sort of an underwater installation with UOM for next year's Science in the City. But yeah, I'm really impressed with what's already going on here.
That's wonderful. Run out of time, I'm afraid.
Yes.
Well, I'd like to thank Ms. Liz Smith, Fulbright Scholar over here from the US, to talk to Malta about science communication. Thank you so much for being with us.
Yes, thank you very much.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġju plilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.